Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. This week, we're broadcasting from St. George. We're at Cafe Feel Love in downtown St. George. Great to be here. Got a live patio audience with us. This is wonderful. We'll be focusing on southern Utah. Here's some of the headlines. It's past the 11th hour. Utah and other Colorado River states call for mediation as current plans near expiration. Lake Powell forecast worsens, on track for the worst year on record, forecasters say. And how a proposed Paiute golf course, golf resort, could strain St. George area's water supply. So joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune Southern Utah reporters, Mark Eddington. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And we have with us Brooke Larson. Thank you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you both with us. Should note that these reporters report for the Salt Lake Tribune, but also the Southern Utah Tribune. Is that correct? Mike, Southern Utah Tribune, their business manager is here with us as well. And periodically, a paper copy of the Southern Utah Tribune comes out. You can find these at sltrib.com as well. Also today, Salt Lake Tribune out from behind the paywall. So free to everybody. But of course, they're looking for donations, just like UPR is nowadays. Let me start with Mark Eddington. Since we have you in person, it's kind of special. Like to get to know you, Mark. Tell a bit about your background.
Thanks. I haven't been called special since I used to live in Utah County. I thought it was kind of redundant. But anyway, a little bit about me. I have been in the journalism business for about 23-24 years. I grew up as an Air Force brat, living all over the place, and I've worked for many papers in the state. I was the editor of an Army newspaper in Germany. I was worked for the Davis County Clipper. That was my first civilian job, and that was the Ogden Standard Examiner and the Daily Herald. I was an opinion page editor there and at the Tribune. And then I left and have worked for about 14, 15 years. I was a press secretary for Senator Hatch, and I was Governor Herbert's speechwriter. And now I've rejoined the dark or light side of the force, depending on who you talk to. And I've been back at the Tribune for about 4 years, working here in southern Utah. And, having a grand time.
So are you okay telling people about what you're gonna do in August?
Sure. I don't know if I should make it widely known in case I fail, but I am walking the Camino del Norte in Spain, and it's about a 520-30 mile pilgrimage walk. Some of you might have seen the movie The Way that was popularized it's 2010, starring Martin Sheen. And that walk is the early Christian followers were known as The Way. The main route is called the Frances. It starts in St. Jean Portapede and winds its way over the Pyrenees across northern Spain, the High Plains, the Meseta, into Santiago de Compostela, where tradition has it that the bones of the Apostle James are buried, which they're not, but nonetheless, it's a good story. But anyway, I'm not taking that route. I'm taking a more challenging and scenic route and a less crowded route, which is the Camino del Norte, and that's about 525 miles. You start in Irun, right across the border from France, and you hug the coast for several hundred miles. And a lot of up and down. You go through San Sebastian, the Basque Country, and so forth. And then the last 100 miles, it kind of winds its way into Santiago de Compostela. So anyway, that's what I'm looking to do in late August for about 5 or 6 weeks, and we'll see if I make it and make it home alive.
That's great. Yeah, that's very interesting. So Brooke Larson, tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I have been down here in St. George with the Southern Utah Tribune and Salt Lake Tribune for about a year now. Prior to that, I lived in Salt Lake City, and I was writing for High Country News. My background's primarily in environmental reporting, covering water, energy, public lands, things like that. So you'll see me write about that often for the Tribune, but I've also really enjoyed covering various community issues down here as well.
Wonderful. Well, Brooke, let's start with you. So a couple of stories here. Let's start with, water is going to be all over in the program today. Maybe we could start with Lake Powell. The forecast isn't great.
Yeah, so Lake Powell is on track to receive its poorest runoff on record, you know, since the reservoir was filled. We just had an awful winter in terms of moisture, poor snowpack, abnormally warm and hot. So the forecast just keeps getting worse and worse in terms of the runoff into the reservoir.
What's the forecast? What do we think it's going to reach?
Yeah, so the forecasts currently show it could reach minimum power pool, which is the level below which the Glen Canyon Dam can't generate hydroelectricity. But equally, if not more significantly, the infrastructure at the dam is not built to sustain long-term releases below that level, which, you know, could have major impacts to states downstream, such as Arizona, California, Nevada, and the country of Mexico. So it's a big deal, and they're doing various things to, you know, release a ton of water out of Flaming Gorge to prop up Powell and reduce how much they're sending down to try and keep it above that level.
So does this forecast include that planned release from Flaming Gorge?
No. So that forecast is if, you know, the Bureau of Reclamation states didn't do these extra measures. So currently their models show that they'll kind of just barely stay at the line they need to prevent that infrastructure damage. But we'll see what happens.
So Lake Powell be delaying regular releases? What are they going to do?
Yeah, so there will be less water coming out of Glen Canyon Dam this year than normal. You know, earlier this year, they were planning to release 7.48 million acre feet. They've reduced that down to 6 million acre feet. So there will just be less water flowing downstream into the Grand Canyon down to Lake Mead.
So in general, it's not a great water year. The forecast is pretty bad for all over, I think.
Yeah, it's not good. A lot of streams have already seen their peak flows this year, which is really abnormally early. The state's projecting that they'll have to cut back water rights holders, you know, to very senior water rights in the 1860s. So farmers across the state are definitely going to feel it. And, you know, municipalities, cities, and towns are also having to, you know, implement drought measures and plan accordingly.
Let's move to a different story, related story. Here's the headline. It's a different lake now. As Lake Powell drops, an iconic marina chases deeper water. This is Bullfrog Marina.
Yeah, so Bullfrog Marina is, you know, the northern marina on Lake Powell. It's particularly popular for visitors to the lake from the north in Utah. And the water has just dropped so much that they can't keep it there any longer safely. And so they're in the process right now of moving that about 3 miles south near Hall's Crossing into some deeper water.
Do they think this is going to have to be permanent or is this temporary?
They are planning for a permanent move. The Park Service is currently, you know, getting a bid for a contractor to build out a new ramp at what's called Staten Creek, which is kind of between Bullfrog and Hall's Crossing. And that's will be the future home of Bullfrog.
Okay. Is that going to affect the price is going to go up or the same prices for the marina?
I have not heard anything about prices going up. I don't think, boaters that have their boats there, I don't think they'll experience that.
Yeah. Let's turn over to Mark Eddington here again on water. There's a proposed golf resort, and we've got some estimates on what this could cost in terms of water. For the complication, this is Paiute. Right. Tribal project.
It's the Shivwits Band of Paiutes. Their reservation is located about, 10 miles west of St. George. A lot of you know they have a huge resort in Ivins, which is west of St. George, called Black Desert Resort. And the developer of Black Desert Resort has been working with the Shivwits Band of Paiutes to put a golf resort on about 1,250 acres of reservation land. We're talking about three courses of 18-hole courses, a shorter practice course, possibly a cultural museum, some lodging, some additional sports courts. So you're talking about a big sports facility, and it's kind of divided the band between those who want it and a resistance group called the Red Mountain Land Preservers, who regard the land as sacred and don't want the golf course there, and feel like that they're losing control of their land and water. The Shibwits get are entitled to about, and there's about 311 members or thereabouts of the federally recognized tribe. Some live on the reservation, the majority of them don't. But the band is entitled with a 2001 water agreement they struck with, you know, state and federal authorities. They're entitled to receive 2,000 acre feet. That's ironclad they receive from St. George. And then they have 1,900 acre feet. And an acre foot, by the way, is about enough to spread a foot of water over an acre. It amounts to about just under 326,000 gallons. But anyway, they're entitled to, they have another 1,900 square feet water rights they and canal companies can draw from Gunlock, but that is not ironclad. That really depends on what kind of water year we're having. So the district, the water district, can cut that and oftentimes does anywhere from 30 to 70%. So this year they might see a 30% reduction on that. So you have and then they get another 100 acre feet from water or wells below the reservation that they're entitled to if they can use it. None of us is drinking water, and they have a small allocation of drinking water they get in addition. And so you have the organizer or the people that support the resort saying they have enough water with that 2,000 acre feet. You have the opponent saying, no, it's not enough water. And they're concerned about losing, you know, the ideas are going to have this resort in place. The Shibwits would make money by leasing the land and their water rights to Reef Capital over possibly long term, maybe 75 or more years. So the band is divided and not getting along right now over this development.
Tell me a little bit more about those internal politics, economic development versus the fear of losing water
right,
rights.
Right. A lot of the... Yes, just not only just water rights, but the land itself, many regard as sacred and feel like this is a betrayal and a sellout, you know, of what they've had in the past. And for many of the Shibwits that I've talked to, they were taught not even to venture up on the land where the golf courses were going because it was sacred and they were told to stay away from it. But on the other hand, you know, you have the proponents of the resort, you know, they say, hey, this could create, you know, 135-140 jobs. It could generate the latest figures I see, and you know, they're not real forthcoming with the figures, but possibly as much as 140 million, maybe over 75 years. So you have this kind of this schism between those, you know, who want the land to kind of remain sacred and what it was, to those who see this as an opportunity for economic development for the tribe, you know, to produce jobs and everything else.
But again, I guess just to underline this, often that most years the tribe would lease back.
Yes, yes.
Water, but that may not happen in the future.
Typically, what happens is because there's not that many on the reservation who actually live on the reservation, but typically they lease anywhere, whatever that water they get, you know, they have some soccer fields, like they lease out there. They have a contract with the Youth Soccer Association for soccer tournament games there, and whatever allocation they get that they don't use for the irrigating the soccer fields, they will lease back anywhere from, like, Zach Renstrom, who's the water district general manager, told me anywhere from like 500 to 1500 acre feet and maybe even 1800 acre feet. But if this resort goes through, you know, that land, that lease can be that they undertake with the tribe, that can be done away with at any time, and that water instead would go to the Shibwits resort. So that would leave it wouldn't be fatal, you know, for the district. I mean, it would nonetheless hurt, and that's, you know, of course, offsetting that, they hope to have Chief Toker Reservoir which is about 4,000 acre feet coming online at the latter end of this year and possibly filling in the spring. And then I think in the following year, on Highway 91, out by the reservation or Santa Clara, they have a graveyard reservoir, which would be 2,000 acre feet. So that would help offset it. But nonetheless, it's a bit of a concern.
Now, I vaguely remember, I don't know, the county or the district put a moratorium on new golf courses.
Yes, they, Zach Renstrom, you know, just basically said, you know, the conventional golf course that they weren't going to approve anymore. I think we have, correct me if I'm wrong, Brooke, but it's about 14, isn't it? 14 golf courses.
Yeah, 13 or 14.
14, yeah, yeah, including the one in Black Desert. And, you know, with water being such a premium down here, especially with the drought, aridification of the area, you know, that's such a premium that I don't think they will approve it anymore. So, nonetheless, that's probably one of the reasons that Reef Capital is approached the Shivwits is because the Shivwits have that water. It's ironclad. It's guaranteed at least 2,000 acre feet. And so they are kind of trying to tap into that for this resort. So they have the Shivwits Band Council has already approved the site plan for that. There's an accompanying airport that Reef Capital wants to put out about 4 or 5 miles, maybe 4 miles west of the resort in an abandoned plant. I think it was an old gypsum mine. And the idea is that they would fly corporate jets in there with high rollers and they would have not only, but of course, Black Desert, which is over nearby Ivins to golf, but then they'd have this, you know, these major golf courses on the Shivwits Reservation. And it would be kind of like, you know, a major golf destination like Pebble Beach and so forth. The band has not signed off on the airport yet, according to documents I've received. They haven't given it to me, but I've been receiving them from opposition. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's really divided the tribe. There are people that are just not speaking to each other. A lot of the band says they're being kept in the dark about the plans. One of the major points of contention is the Shivwits Jurisdictional Clarity Act, which is something that the band is pushing, or Reef Capital, I guess. Well, Reef Capital says it's the band. They're pushing so that it would facilitate more long-term development on the reservation, economic development. The band's contention is that, you know, federal law is a little bit uncertain. And so when it comes to resolving a dispute, say, in a contract with a developer, you know, it'd be better instead of resorting to tribal courts, whatever tribal courts they have, to have give some of that jurisdiction over to the state courts where it could be adjudicated civil matters. And also the act would also, there's a 25-year cap on how long you can lease land and water under current federal statute. It would open the way for that to be up to, I think, 75 years. And then you have the opposition saying, you know, that's just an end run around, you know, trying to circumvent what the tribe really wants. You have the resistance group saying most of the Shivwits are not in favor of it, and that the federal law already exists that where the band, as a band-wide vote can take place, where they could vote, you know, to give part of that jurisdiction to the state without having the state or the federal government dictate it. So they feel like it's a way of doing an end run around existing statute and not letting the band vote on it and decide whether this is something they really want. So it's really divided the tribe, and there's a lot of hard, bad feelings, a lot of accusations flying.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And we have with us reporters Mark Eddington and Brooke Larson. Following a break, we'll turn to Brooke again to talk about how the Colorado River Compact states are trying to get along, trying to get a new agreement. It's not going so well, all right? And you talk to somebody to see whether a mediator would work. So we'll start with that story following this brief break.
Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us reporters Brooke Larson and Mark Eddington. So, Mark, you wanted to add something on the previous
story? Yeah, I talked a little bit about the Chivas Jurisdictional Clarity Act. Senator Curtis and Representative Malloy pushed companion bills. Ostensibly, the band leadership, the Chivas Bank Council, said that this really legislation was not resort specific. But anyway, when John Senator Curtis found out his staff that there was a lobbyist that was pushing for this legislation, when they found out that he represented Reef Capital and not the tribe, that Reef Capital was paying this lobbyist over much of the year, tens of thousands of dollars, and they pressed the pause button. In the meantime, Representative Malloy's bill has gone through past the House and is now before the Senate, I want to say Indian Affairs Committee, but that's kind of where that is now. And so, you know, the opponents are saying, hey, if this isn't resort specific, if it doesn't have anything to do with Reef Capital, then why are they paying a lobbyist all this money to get this legislation passed? So, you know, to which I think the attorney for the Chivas, Mark Echohawk, said that they were doing it out of the goodness of their heart and to help the band. So,
Okay. Thanks for that addition. Let's turn to Brooke Larson. You and I have talked on this program several times about this. The upper river states, the lower river states, the Colorado River trying to reach a new agreement. That's due this year, I think, right?
I mean, the states have been negotiating for, you know, probably as long as the Colorado River Compact's been in place, for over 100 years. But the past couple of years, they have been renegotiating new guidelines specifically to how to manage this river system in particularly dry years.
Yeah. So give us a refresher course. Who are the upper states, who are the lower states, and what's the beef?
Yeah, so the upper basin includes Utah, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Colorado. The lower basin is Arizona, California, and Nevada. The dividing line is at Lee's Ferry, just below Glen Canyon Dam. The beef, basically, we're in a situation right now where there's less and less water, as we were talking about earlier. And so it becomes increasingly heated and difficult to figure out how to share a river that, you know, naturally less is flowing through due to, you know, climate change induced drought, as well as just this river has been over allocated. So there's less and less to go around. You know, these areas are growing. There's a lot of conservation efforts and efficiency efforts, but we are in a rapidly growing region of the U.S. and with less and less water.
Yeah. And of course, famously, Colorado River doesn't reach the sea, right? The estuary is dry. Yeah. I know one sticking point, the lower basin states say, hey, we're doing a great job conserving, and you upper basin states are doing a bad job.
Yeah, so one major sticking point in these negotiations is the lower basin has really wanted the upper basin, you know, states like Utah, to commit to what they're calling verifiable water reductions. So commit to a specific number of water that these states like Utah will use less of each year. That gets tricky because in the upper basin, in Utah, we don't necessarily know how much water is going to flow in the rivers and streams here each year. So, for example, Utah has a water conservation effort where farmers can, you know, make commitments of they're going to use X amount less water. And those programs have not been able to reach their full potential because the water just simply wasn't there to conserve in the stream. So that is Utah's argument. Other, like Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico's argument is that Mother Nature already makes cuts in the upper basin every year, but that's not good enough for the lower basin so far. And they aren't willing to say that they won't sue states like Utah down the line where, you know, potentially going to break some of the commitments the lower basin says upper basin states has to make in the Colorado River Compact this year, potentially. So Utah really wants that guarantee that states like Arizona won't sue them. But Arizona, California, Nevada aren't willing to make that guarantee until states like Utah say, we will conserve X amount of water.
So the idea of mediation is being floated. And you asked an expert. You asked the question, what will that actually help? So who did you talk to?
Yeah, I talked with Danya Rumore at the Environmental Dispute Resolution Program that's currently at the University of Utah. They are moving to Utah State this summer. So I talked with her about this proposal from the Upper Basin to bring on an independent mediator. The federal government has been facilitating a lot of these negotiations, but as some people have pointed out, the federal government really isn't an independent entity. They, you know, manage the reservoirs like Lake Powell and Lake Mead. They have federal trust responsibilities with the tribes, so they also have their own interests in this.
And you asked what makes this conflict particularly challenging. We talked a little bit about that. So anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think something else that Danya brought up was just, you know, we're talking about seven states as well as the country of Mexico, you know, a lot of tribes. This is a very complex issue with a lot of interests. And so when a state negotiator comes to the table, they're representing elected officials that appointed them, they're representing farmers, they're representing, you know, the cities and towns where people live. So there's a lot at stake. There's a lot of people they have to represent. And it's also complicated science that people can kind of weaponize, is what Danya said. You know, it can not be used to sort of further the conversation, but be used to kind of muddle it. So these are some of the factors that make these negotiations so difficult.
And the water levels, the moisture, the water we're receiving keeps being a moving target, right?
Throughout
year, it seems to be getting worse and worse.
Yeah, so this is really, you know, the worst year on record. And like I kind of said earlier, as there's less and less water, that just makes these even more tense because, you know, people are worried, fear is rising. So under these tense times, it just becomes even more difficult for people to come to the table in a calm, maybe level-headed way.
You also talked about the Glen Canyon Dam. We talked about that earlier in the program. We may go below power level this summer. I guess that's on both the upper states and the lower states' mind.
Yeah, definitely. That's a major issue. Just as you know, I mentioned earlier, the dam can't sustain long term releases below that level. At least that's what, you know, engineering models and tests have shown, that there could start to be infrastructure damage. So certainly states like Arizona and California want to make sure water can keep flowing downstream through that dam. You know, several states rely on power from the dam as well. So yeah, the states don't want to see that for sure.
So if there's not an agreement reached, would the federal government step in and say this is the agreement?
So the federal government to a certain level has to do that. So they operate these dams and they have to have new operation plans in place by October 1st. The last I heard, states expect the federal government to release a draft of that in June, and then in July, we may see the final record of decision on that. And so I think the big question is, what will the federal government put in that, given that the federal government does have limited legal authorities? And so there's concerns that without a agreement from the states, that the federal government won't be able to do what's needed to ultimately keep Powell above that minimum power pool, make sure water gets to everyone who has rights to it, things like that. But we'll see what's in there. What I've heard from states is, you know, they will likely agree to something short term, or the federal government will put out this plan short term, and then they'll continue to hash it out over the next few years for a longer term plan.
I'm sure you'll be reporting on this as we go along. Thank
you. Yes.
Ms. Larson. Before we go to break, I want to turn back to Mark Eddington. Here's a non-water story. Here's how much St. George paid to settle a lawsuit over all ages drag show. First of all, tell us about this drag show.
Well, it's a drag show that the Southern Utah Drag Stars wanted to hold in a public park several years ago. And they claimed they had a permit. The city rescinded it. Southern Utah Drag Stars sued. The federal judge sided with them in the lawsuit. Eventually, they settled on that, and city issued apologized for violating their First Amendment rights, their constitutional rights, and issued a formal written apology. But we didn't know exactly what the settlement entailed, how much it cost the city. Some of that came to light recently. It was we learned that the federal judge ordered St. George to cop up $350,000 to pay for legal fees. I submitted a grammar request trying to figure out to get exactly what the settlement agreement entailed. Eventually, the city of St. George denied it. I appealed to the state records committee, and person there, the judge found, said that that St. George had violated the spirit of grandma. But nonetheless, he could not order a judge because it was sealed in court to unseal it. So we haven't known. We still don't know what the overall settlement agreement is. We do, however, St. George decided why the overall settlement agreement. They decided when Fox News asked just for how much money they gave to Southern Utah Drag Stars, they decided that was a public record. So they just released that, and they paid $30,000 to Southern Utah Drag Stars to compensate them, you know, for what they did. So you're looking at 350 plus 30, what, $380,000. And of course, you know, those of you who live in the area know that as a few years back, the city manager, Adam Lenhart, was let go, forced out when he refused to rescind a permit for them to hold a drag, not Southern Utah Drag Stars, but another, it was an HBO program to hold a drag show. And when he said that the city would run into legal problems and run afoul of the Constitution by doing so, he was forced out, and the city gave him a secret settlement of $625,000. And eventually, you know, we were able, the Tribune was able to come up with exactly how much that cost. So you combine all that, and, you know, you're looking at the city, the taxpayers are out about $1 million.
Well, so, by the way, the legislature, I think a couple of sessions ago, made changes to the grandma process.
Yeah.
Is that throwing up extra barriers for you?
Well, I don't think it makes it easier. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more costly potentially, and then harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Today, we're broadcasting from Cafe Feel Love in St. George. And we have a great audience, a live audience here, and you're listening as well. Thank you so much. We have with the Southern Utah reporters, Brooke Larson and Mark Eddington. We're talking about Southern Utah issues on the program today. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're doing a special broadcast from St. George. We're at Cafe Feel Love in downtown St. George today, focusing on Southern Utah issues. And we have with us Southern Utah Tribune reporters Mark Eddington and Brooke Larson. So good to have all of you guys with us, live audience with us as well. Thank you so much. Let's turn to you, Brooke. Here's the headline. One of the most important living laboratories. Scientists raise alarms over push by Lee and Malloy to scrap the National Monument Plan. Of course, Senator Lee and Congresswoman Malloy. So what are they trying to do?
Yeah, so Senator Lee and Representative Malloy have entered what's called a joint resolution of disapproval for the management plan for the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. We expect a vote on that, or at least my sources expect a vote on that in the next couple weeks. They have, you know, a 60-day period to do this with a simple majority vote. And so Scientists yesterday sent out a letter. There were over 150 scientists and different scientific organizations that asked Congress to vote no on this resolution.
So tell me about the process here. It's kind of an arcane process in Congress that the senator and the congressperson are using, right?
Yeah, so it's under the Congressional Review Act. Malloy last year asked the Government Accountability Office to determine if this monument plan could be considered a rule under the Congressional Review Act. The GAO said that it is in January. So that means that it, you know, must undergo congressional review and that Congress can ultimately vote in favor of these resolutions of disapproval and undo the plan. And basically, if Congress does vote in support of this, the Bureau of Land Management, which manages Grand Staircase, can't create a new management plan that's substantially similar to the previous one that was disapproved.
So these scientists are warning that if we have a different plan, that the science will be lost.
That is the concern, especially this like substantially similar requirement under the Congressional Review Act. There's a lot of uncertainty in this, I would say. At least that's what my sources tell me, just because this would be the first time that the Congressional Review Act is used to throw out a monument management plan. So that substantially similar line has not really been thoroughly tested, particularly for national monument plans. But the concern is, you know, this national monument was designated in part because of the scientific resources, you know, dinosaur fossils, things like that. And so, yeah, these scientists worry that some of that could be threatened depending on what a future plan looks like. There's also a scientist, Jackie Grant, the director of the Grand Staircase Escalante Partners Group, raised that, you know, scientists like some certainty when they're doing their research. So changing up the plan, you know, can make it harder for scientists to do their research in the monument.
Mm-hmm. It was a 60-day period, I think. When is that ending?
Yeah. So, you know, it's based on 60 continuous session days. So it depends on, you know, when as Senate and House are in session. This was entered into the congressional record. That's when that clock starts at the end of February. And my sources and kind of their calculating and talking with people in Congress think that that could happen around June 8th or 10th, somewhere in that window.
Okay. We're about 10 minutes left in the program. We'll have some other stories we want to talk about. It occurs to me we have a live audience here. If you have any questions, we'd invite you to come forward and ask a question of our reporters. So just think about that. We have about 10 minutes. You can get a question in if you would like. We'd love to do that. Let's turn to Mark. So a couple of these stories are kind of a little softer, which is kind of nice, right?
So, you know, even a reporter has to have fun every now and again.
That's right, yeah. So here's the headline. Popular St. George Garden has a curious new resident. Who could it be? Who is a clue there? Tell us about this.
Well, they had a great horned owls, a family, take residence up there, you know, a mother and three owlets in kind of a cavity of the rock right in some the Red Cliffs Reserve land right adjacent to the garden, right next to it. And you know, some bird watchers noticed it, word got out, pictures came all over social media. And so the concern was, you know, that the public might, in their over-exuberation about it, might stress out the mom and she'd quit feeding the owlets and so forth. So the Washington County Water Conservancy District, most notably or specifically Doug Bennett, was out there with a spotting scope and putting signage out. And the county, they put some barricades out and tried to manage it a little bit, and which became harder when two of the owlets fledged and jumped down and left. They don't really nest in the conventional sense, but the cavity, and then they're kind of hopping around very awkwardly on the ground. And, you know, the mother is up there with the remaining owlet, and I guess she would come down sometime during the night, to feed them and try to keep track of them. And the dad, which is somewhere around, the cavity wasn't big enough for all of them, but he was supposedly coming around during the night and doing DoorDash and feeding the owlets as well, because they can't really fly for several weeks. And so they're easy prey, and they can't hunt. They don't learn how to hunt. I mean, they learn essentially through trial and error, but probably till fall. So they're no longer there. The remaining owlet has come out. They've gravitated. They're somewhere. Presumably they're still intact as a family. They're amazing in many respects because, first of all, about 80% of them don't make it. They become prey to coyotes, other predators, ravens, and different things. They get caught up in power lines. They get run over by cars. But they're amazing. They're one of the few predators, raptors I family, that can eat skunks, because as acute as their eyesight and their hearing is, they don't have a very good sense of smell. So it doesn't really faze them. So they can eat skunks. Of course, you know that owls can turn their head much a wider radius than we can. Humans, what, we can do it about, what, 90 degrees or something? Mm. And then I have to put a cold pack or something. But skunks have twice as many neck bones, and so they can rotate much further. I don't know if it's about 270 degrees. It's that much. But anyway, that was just kind of a fun story. They're pretty common, but because they're nocturnal for the most part, you don't see them. I've maybe had one encounter where I'm getting out of my hot tub one morning, one flew right over my head and kind of freaked me out. But anyway, it was a nice feel-good story.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
If they're still alive.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Brooke Larson, here's a feel-good story. This Southern Utah HOA ditched this thirsty turf. Now it's saving water and money. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So this was one of the homes that was featured in the recent Parade of Gardens Southern Utah. So I was able to talk with them just about how they found that it would, save the HOA money actually to rip out the lawns in their front yards and replace it with water-wise landscaping.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Mark, you did maybe just very briefly on this. You did a story on the Zion Lodge.
Yes, it's celebrated its centennial anniversary, and they had an event to celebrate that. It's been around for 100 years, like I said, and of course, I think the original burned down, and it's come back in its latest reincarnation, which kind of original. Commemorates or pays homage to the original design, and that was nice to see that. There was a painting that was unveiled by, I can't remember the artist's name, but he's an acclaimed landscape artist and a commercial artist that's trained out of BYU, and the focus on that was the lodge, yes, but also that huge cottonwood tree out in front of the lodge that is such an iconic thing, as so many people gather there under the shade of that huge tree. Yeah, which is evidently nearing the end of its age, and they don't know how much longer it'll last. But anyway, that was a wonderful event. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming down to the last few minutes here, before we do underplayed stories, Brooke, what are you working on? What can people look forward to?
Yeah, well, last night I was up in Cedar City late. There's, a few data centers proposed up there. And so there was an open house about that, where residents of Iron County raised concerns until about 9 p.m. last night. So we'll have a story out on that today.
All right. Mark, what are you working on?
Well, I have another couple of Shibwit stories I'm working on. One has about is about campaign donations to Malloy, who's the primary person behind the Shibwit's Clarity Act. I'm looking to do a story on a wildlife rehabilitator, who a feature story, who he and his golden eagle, they've been 20 years together, where they've been learning. He's taught his golden eagle how to hunt, and is, I think, one of the only ones that has permission to do so. His name's Martin Tyner, so yeah. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But basically, I have a couple of shoes. I have one about coming out, I believe it's Monday, although that's like scientific truth is forever tentative, but it's how much water it would take you know, the Shibwits are talking about 3.5 golf courses or 3 in a shorter practice course, how much water that would take and if that would exhaust their full allocation. Yeah. So yeah, that will be the focus on that one.
Okay, great. I'm going to pull a surprise. Mike, I wonder, could I have you make a surprise appearance here? Might remind me your last name, and you're the business manager for Southern Utah Tribune?
Mike Ginsmore, yes. I'm the general manager.
General manager for Southern Utah Tribune. So just a couple of minutes, tell us what the Southern Utah Tribune is.
Southern Utah Tribune is the nonprofit local paper providing information and insight to the local stories and issues that are going on in Southern Utah.
All right. Yeah. And there's a paper edition.
We print a paper edition once a month. We hit 40,000 homes here in Southern Utah. And then we've got a weekly newsletter that comes out on Fridays.
Yeah. And you find this sltrib.com or where else?
No. SL Trib will get you one way. SouthernUtah.org is another way. So there's several, yes.
Yeah. And the reporters essentially Mark and Brooke, right?
Yep. Yeah. These are my two local reporters.
Yeah.
Everyone loves the stories. And yeah, take a chance to look at their articles and read them. And they do a great job at the research and covering the issues that are going on here in Southern Utah.
Okay, great. That's a great thing Trib is doing. Appreciate that.
Emphasis on local. L-O-C-O.
Loco. There you go. Okay. All right. Well, let's do underplayed stories of the week. And this need not be Southern Utah. Anything you'd like to highlight?
Oh, I think it's getting a lot of attention, but I think Brooke's Colorado River reporting is so important, and the implications can be so dire that I just think you can't play that one up enough.
Yeah.
As well as the data centers. I mean, yes, they're getting a lot of attention, but they need even more. So I just don't think you could stress that enough.
Yeah. There will be a data center story coming from you, Brooke, I guess, coming up. What's your underplayed? You could do more than one.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is underplayed or not, but you know, the Tribune just made the transition to free for all this week. And there's a few posts from our reporters on about what that means and why we think it's important. And I feel proud to be, you know, working for a nonprofit paper that's making news as accessible as possible. So I think that's pretty exciting, and hope people read those stories about why we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to the Salt Lake Tribune tote bags and such as they fully embrace the public radio.
Yeah. Model. Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck on that.
Yeah. That's a great development. And we're proud of our partnership with the Tribune.
Yes.
With through Behind the Headlines and other partnerships. We also mentioned here, we share Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune share a Northern Utah reporter. Cache Valley reporter is shared between Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune. So there's another partnership with the Tribune. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the week the news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've had with us reporter Mark Eddington. Thanks.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
And I'll look forward to a report for your trip to Spain coming up.
Me too.
Brooke Larson, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thanks, everybody, and our live audience here. Appreciate it.